We've heard the beginning of George Rochberg's Fourth Symphony, as performed by the Seattle Youth Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Willem Solkal. George Rochberg is my guest. You've been called a neoromanticist. I'd like to know what you think of the use of that term.
Well, it's an odd term, you know, because the 20th century has been full of neo this and neo that. And I suppose what people are trying to say with these almost slogan-like phrases, they're trying to suggest that there is a connection, perhaps a serious connection, you know, between, if you say, neoclassicism, which was the epithet that, you know, was hurled at Stravinsky. People, I suppose, were trying to say, well, it sounds like the old classical music. But of course it's not. And neoromanticism is a curious phrase because it suggests that what composers are trying to do, if they are writing, let's say, tonal music, which begins to sound melodic and has a clear structural line that you can follow, that this evokes all kinds of associations with earlier 19th century music. I am not ashamed in the least of any sense of association between, let's say, what I've written in the last 10 years or so and the 19th century. The only difference in my mind is that the so-called romantic, the new romantic movement, which is supposed to be moving along these days, comes out of a reaction against modernism. And that's a very, very different thing from, let's say, just simply bypassing a modernist notion or a modernist aesthetic and trying to make some kind of connection, superficial or deep, with the old music. I can't speak for other composers because I think everyone who's writing either tonal music or a kind of mixed tonal, atonal music, which also preoccupies me because I'm not strictly, I haven't just gone from one extreme to another extreme. What strikes me as the essential difference, at least in my work, is the darkening of the musical palette. And this is, for me, very important because it means that in giving up, let's say, the more obvious possibilities with modern music, you have to go inside. Now, that may sound like a kind of an odd thing. All art comes from inside, one way or the other. But it's a question of, you know, how far deep inside you go. One of the things which I think is not widely talked about, although I think that some composers that I have talked with about this are as aware of it as I am, and that's the connection between the impulse, let's say, to write a new kind of music and what's creating the particular quality and texture of that impulse, whatever the personal differences are from composer to composer. And I think we're pretty much all agreed that what's creating that impulse is that the new romanticism, if we insist on the, you know, that phrase, I don't personally, although I wouldn't deny, of course, that I am a romantic composer. I've always been a romantic composer, one way or the other. But the impulse really comes from a time when we're under the threat of nuclear destruction. And there's so many aspects to this particular time which are totally debilitating to most people. You might almost say the wreckage of our civilization, which shows up in many, many different ways, some more advanced than others. In wanting to write this kind of music, what we're really affirming is life. That's a quite different thing from the kinds of impulses, let's say, which affected a Brahms at the end of the 19th century, or a Mahler, or a Bruckner. It's not that they were not also affirming life. But we see, for example, in Mahler, I've always had the feeling that the almost near heartbreak quality of his music comes from his own awareness that his civilization, his time, is breaking up. He doesn't know what's going to follow. His peculiar intuitions are all too right, in a sense. And when you realize he died in 1911, 3 years later, in August of 1914, the first guns of the First World War went off, and that was the real beginning of the 20th century. I mean, if you take the calendar 1900 as the beginning of the 19th century, it's not quite true, culturally speaking. But if you take the beginning of the breakup of the old world with the First World War, that's when you really have the true characteristics of the 20th century. So some 70 years later, we find ourselves, I find myself, struggling with the realization that our world is also now in terrible trouble, great trouble. And there's no way in which the arts can affect it. I'm absolutely convinced that while art is necessary to the existence of a civilization and to the existence of individual people and large groups of people who love painting, love music, literature, and so on, but we cannot really affect the basic direction and nature of the political movements which are going on in the world, which have no particular concern for, let's say, let's call it the life-asserting forces. I mean, all the militarism which is going on right now in America, the arming, the saber rattling, the breakdown of talks with the Soviet Union. I find this all very profoundly disturbing. And if it doesn't, put me under a psychological cloud, and I can somehow cut through this miasma of you know, troubled sensations, then I can work. And that's the hard thing. And perhaps it was maybe just as hard to work in the late 19th century. I don't know. But certainly Mahler's work, in Mahler's work, you sense that something is ending. Now, the other side of this whole thing, of course, is that in a peculiar way, I also feel something new is beginning. And that, of course, its life, its capacity to send out a trajectory into the future depends absolutely on what happens in terms of the larger political picture of the world. But if this new thing, this new impulse, has half a chance, I think we will see a really marvelous art again. Because what we're doing, in a sense, is working from the ruins of modernism. I once had a dream, and I sometimes dream, we all dream visually, but at the end of a dream, sometimes the dream is, captured in a verbal phrase. And this particular phrase was the bright, shiny ruins of modernism. And that juxtaposition of the bright, shiny, but ruins of modernism is precisely where we are right now. And I think
you mean
all
musically
artists, or in all the arts, I'm convinced in all the arts, the necessity to somehow find a way out, to assert these larger feelings again.
George Rochberg is my guest. What do you think are some of the failings of modernism that people want to find a way out of now?
Well, there are many, but I think to generalize, at least, and to talk briefly, because you can appreciate the fact that this is an enormous subject. I don't think it's ever been understood, certainly not by those of us who are living it, and maybe in another 50 or 75 years. But among the things that I find which are clear earmarks of or benchmarks of modernism are, for example, the profound tendency to reductionism, so that at the end of, let's say, a whole cycle of wildly oscillating movements back and forth, starting from about 1910, you end up with what we call minimalism, where if you look at a canvas, it's all black or it's all white. Or if you hear a piece of music, what you hear are, you know, very elemental, repetitive figures. Now, all of this may be very appealing, and apparently it is to some people, but its appeal can't last for very long, because art, it seems to me, has to have those layers which not only bring you from the surface of the work into the work, but as you move more and more into the depths of the work, you get more and more residue from it. It affects the visual memory, it affects the verbal memory, it affects the oral memory, if you're thinking about music. See, one of the biggest problems about 20th century music in terms of modernism is that very little of it can be remembered. That's an odd thing. It struck me a long time ago, what a painful thing to be involved as an artist. And I take it as a given that all artists are serious people. I've never met one who really wasn't. But how painful to spend a lifetime producing work, which, let's say, leaves nothing on the retina of memory. And that's one of the very serious flaws of modernism. Then, of course, you can see that the tendency toward abstractionism. You know, there are many ways of performing abstractionism in art. You can go from, it's easier in a way to talk about, let's say, Kandinsky. Kandinsky's wild, wonderful early 1913-14 landscapes, which tend toward abstractionism. But then when he turns in 23 to a kind of, it's not cubistic, but it's more geometric. It's cold, very ordered, very clear, but there's circles and squares and triangles and so on, intersecting, and so almost a spatial kind of image. But these are the things which begin to erode the emotional content. And if you were to compare, if it were possible to measure, let's say, the emotional content or the depth of emotional content in, a Cezanne, for example, whom I love, with, let's say, a minimalist. Well, you'd just on a scale of 10, you'd be going from 10 for Cezanne all the way down to 0 for the minimalist. This would have nothing to do with the judgment, the aesthetic judgment, as to whether the work is valid or not as art, but just simply in terms of what you can look at, what you can think about, what you can carry away with you. Well, if you, let's say now, apply that to a musical situation, and you think of what you can take away with you from a Beethoven, from a Mozart, from a Mahler, from a Bruckner, and whether you can take anything away at all from, let's say, composers who have insisted absolutely on the most extreme forms of avant-gardism.
You want to give some examples of the composers you're thinking of?
Well, for example, and it's curious, in almost every case, we're talking about composers who were most active in the 50s and 60s. And if I do talk about avant-gardism or modernism, I'm really talking about the climax of the movement. Because you have to separate modernism into periods. Now, I'm no historian, but of course Stravinsky and Schoenberg and Béla Bartók, they're modern. But they were tied to their past. They were 19th century people. They were born in the 19th century. And they were still thinking in terms of the composers of that time. But if you say Boulez, you see, or if you say Stockhausen, or if you say Berlioz, these are composers who really come to first consciousness after the Second World War. And, of course, they are the European avant-garde, and they had a very profound effect, in a way, on American music after the Second World War. And as this music went on, it was very ingenious in its construction. See, these are great constructioners. But it's one thing to, let's say, think about the constructional elements of a Brahms symphony, which are quite fantastic, you know, really quite amazing. But they are simply the strut or the skeletal or the armature through which or on which, you know, the real life of the work exists. But if all you end up with, and this, of course, is the work of abstractionism, is an awareness of the intellectual structure, well, you can't really think about that too long without beginning to want something else, without beginning to wish that there was something more warm and warming about the experience. So I found myself, in, let's say, in the early 60s, beginning to turn violently away from all of this, which had fascinated me.
Well, you said it, that you felt serialism was even liberating when you started to work in that form. How could it be that it first felt liberating and then felt constricting? What was liberating about it when you started?
Well, it's curious that I approached serialism from a totally non-intellectual point of view. And in order to be a serial composer, I mean, you've got to, in fact, deal with that side of it because it demands a great deal of just sheer brain work and brain power. I approached it emotionally. I discovered about 1948, 49, and this is after I had first come to grips with Schoenberg. You see, Schoenberg was like a huge mountain that everyone had to deal with, whether they liked it or not. You either went around him or over him, if you could, or through him in some, you know, magical way. But you had to contend. You couldn't just turn away from him because he occupied such an enormous space on the musical landscape. And what I found fascinating about Schoenberg was not so much initially, that is, not the the constructional elements, which turn out, of course, to be absolutely amazing and brilliant, and still probably among the very best serial music ever written. But I found myself fascinated by the emotional violence. A phrase comes to mind of a friend, an old friend. She once used it in relation to an early piece of mine. She said it was radiantly violent. Well, that's a term which I think can apply very readily to Schoenberg. And also, this linked up with necessities of my own, which had begun to come to the fore after the war, and I began to feel that I needed to break away from a more conservative bent, which I had been pursuing before the war and as a student right after the war. And so when I began to write 12-tone music, or what later became known as serialism, and of course, as you know, serialism is essentially a very particular way of ordering or bringing structural order into the 12 chromatic notes. It means that you give up the idea of the simple scale, let's say the C major scale or the C minor scale, and the key. Serialism attempts to impose other kinds of order than key, so that you no longer have a tonality, you have non-tonality. It's almost a kind of a negative condition. And that's the way, in fact, Schoenberg and Berg and Webern approached it. So what was liberating for me was that it gave me the expressive means with which to say the things that I was beginning to feel just around the time I was turning 31. And the curious thing is that if I hadn't had that emotional internal pressure to go in that direction, I don't think I would have ever bothered, because the purely constructional or constructivist aspects are hardly worth the candle in their own terms. But see, what happened, and this is another flaw, I think, in the developing modernist idea, those things which were originally means, and they were means for Schoenberg and the others, became ends. And that's why they became so prominent, really, or surrealism became such a prominent way among academic composers, among which I hasten to add I never considered myself, even though I spent almost, 25 years at the university. But the sharp difference between, let's say, expressiveness or expressive means and structure is, I think, what determines whether or not you're one kind of composer or not in the 20th century. Whereas in the 19th century, you can't separate them. You really can't.
My guest is George Rochberg, composer, if you're just joining us. I'd like to play part of another one of your symphonies, and we're going to hear the second part of the second symphony. This is from the 1960s. Maybe you can discuss this piece for us in terms of the issues you've just been going into.
Yes, well, I'd be glad to. Actually, it was written in 1955, 56, and it still stands for me as, one of my major statements, but not because it's 12-tone. Far, far, far from it, because essentially it's a very powerfully expressive piece. Now, I can't say what it's expressive of, but perhaps in a sense the term radiant violence applies to it. It's a very intense piece. It's in one movement, which would say there are four sections which take the place of the traditional four movements, but there is no stopping and starting. One of the problems, too, I just might touch on this, that the 20th century has made possible, and this I see as an absolutely valid and viable way to think, and I'm sure it will continue. It certainly does for me, and that is generally the 19th century and 18th century composers tended to write, if they were writing multi-movement pieces, you started and you stopped. You started and you stopped. You started and you stopped. Now, that's much, much more serious a problem than, let's say, the ordinary layman might think it is, because you've got to get something going, and then you've got to know how to bring it to a close. And it's curious, as much as I love Brahms, there are pieces of his where the ending is, for me, not satisfying, because what he does is aborts it, you see. So in its place, what's happened is the possibility of writing, I suppose, what you might call a looser structured, more fantasia-like work, where you don't stop and start or start and stop, but you start and you have these, let's say, open-ended spots and something new comes out of it. So the piece really is continuing. And so what that means is there's got to be one ending and only one ending. And in this particular work, the ending, for me, is perhaps its best structural aspect, you see, as well as expressive.
Well, we'll be hearing the beginning of George Rochberg's Symphony No. 2 with Werner Tarkanovsky conducting the New York Philharmonic Orchestra.
Thank you.
heard the opening passage of George Rockberg's Symphony No. 2, performed by the New York Philharmonic with Werner Tarkanowski conducting. George Rockberg is my guest, and he lives in suburban Philadelphia. For 23 years, he was on the faculty of the University of Pennsylvania, where he also for several years was the chair of the music department. He recently retired from the university. You were saying before that one of the things that modernism does is challenge the conventions of music. And I think that that's a kind of constant process in any art, that a movement comes along, challenges the basic assumptions of it, breaks it, maybe pares it down to its basics, and then things are built in it again. Having been through serialism and then left it, are there any other conventions that you're still happy to do without, that being a temporary serialist enabled you to get out of or helped you to challenge?
Well, this is a very big question and has enormous implications. Without, you know, spending a lot of time talking about what preceded the modern period, I think it's important to recognize, first of all, that whatever happened from, let's say, the time of the Baroque on until the end of the 19th century or the turn of the century, the crossover into the early 20th century, there was really essentially only one language, and that was the tonal language, from a certain both structural, integral, and emotional point of view. The tonal language is the most stable language that the West has produced to this time. It's impossible to talk, for example, about modern music without realizing, or certainly at least pointing to, the fact that when modernism arose in music, which was in the first decade of the 20th century, it happened simultaneously in all the arts. And it didn't happen in America, it happened in Europe. In recent years, I've come to realize myself, and I talk about the fact that modernism begins as a European cultural revolution, kind of a consciousness explosion. The Europeans were, let's say, the recipients of an incredible series of artistic traditions. But something happened in the early 20th century. It may have something to do with the breakup of the political situation, with the breakdown of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which was, of course, the result of the First World War. Whatever the specific causes are, the point is that there was an enormous need to break with the past. And in giving up the past, all of the ways of working, let's say, musically, or working as a painter, or writing as a novelist and a poet, all of these things underwent an enormous change, a total revolution of a kind, so that when modernism began to search out the various different ways that it could proceed without falling back at any point on the conventions of, or the traditional conventions of the 19th or 18th and 19th centuries, it's almost as though everyone proceeded by negative impulse rather than positive impulse. And this legacy, which my generation and composers younger than mine and artists similarly in the other media, is a very difficult thing, because it means that having gone from the positive aspects of a very stable way of working, which allowed, let's say, all kinds of individual stylistic personal tendencies without disrupting the language, you go from that to the disruption of language, and everyone is off on his own trying to create his own language and his own way, but always with the shadow of the past on him and the clear consciousness that you can't go back to these things. Well, what happened to me and what other composers are beginning to feel, and for example, if I can just mention here that I read recently that Frank Stella, who was a young painter and well-known in this country, about 48, maybe 49, is now talking about what painters lost when they gave up Caravaggio and what they lost when they gave up Rembrandt and so on. Now, he was an absolute abstractionist. He was probably the second or third generation abstract expressionist, you know, the New York school. This sense of what had been given up, and whether it's attached to guilt or sense of loss, it's hard to say, but this is part of the battle to reclaim these things. So, for example, when I started to write tonal music again, and it took about almost a decade from the time I first got the impulse, the necessity, the desire to do this in a serious way, until the point where I really could do it and manage it in a way which was my own, what happened was that you had to reclaim, let's say, the aspects of the old music.
But doesn't that keep it alive? If there wasn't the avant-garde always challenging the conventions of an art, you'd be following them not because you wanted to necessarily, but because you had no choice and you were expected to, and at that point it becomes mannerism. So if it's constantly being challenged and then you reaffirm it, isn't it end up being a much more personal, committed statement?
I agree, and from the point of view, you know, that your question implies, we could say we owe a great deal to the avant-garde for having raised the question in such a serious way that it forced us to re-examine, in fact, what the situation was, what the true nature of the situation was in purely artistic terms. And in this sense, I don't even mean cultural. I mean artistic in the way that any one of us who's trying to make art has to work. But you see, you don't, unfortunately, it would be wonderful if, in fact, it could be so, that you arrive at a decision or a level of decision, and that's it. You know, there you are. You've achieved this ultimate plateau. It doesn't happen that way. Because once you've made one inroad into the solution of the problem, it brings with it all kinds of other questions. And so I find myself, for example, now beginning to think that there is something else that must happen as a result of, let's say, the confrontation of this new attitude, call it new romanticism or whatever you like to call it, and the old avant-garde. And that is that we have to eventually confront the fact that having passed through the period that we're now engaged in, trying to, let's say, personally express these life-asserting forces, we're going to have to find a more precise way of structuring all this. And that, I think, is going to take us into what, for lack of a better term, you might call again the new classicism. But this would have nothing to do with the neoclassicism that, let's say, was typical of Stravinsky in the 1920s. This would not be an aping of a Bach or a Mozart, or it would go deeper than that in the sense that it would have to do with how you structure your ideas and how you balance the subjective side and the objective side. See, one of the problems is that we have flip-flopped back and forth from pure subjectivism to pure objectivism, and this is enough to make you dizzy. If you start thinking about it, and thinking about it in terms of specific works or specific artists, composers, painters, and so on, it's like watching a speeded up ping pong game in purely cultural terms.
I'd like to play another passage from one of your recent pieces, and we're going to hear part of Imago Mundi. Would you discuss what's happening in this piece?
Well, this again is a totally different kind of piece, and this follows pretty rapidly on the heels of the third quartet, which was the piece with which I sort of, you might say, I broke through into the area of tonality that I'd been trying to get to for a long time. And the reason why it's different is because it's less structural in the more obvious sense of the term and more imagistic, which is to say that the music, how shall I put it, the music focuses on images which have to do with texture and color and repetitive figures rather than a line which starts and takes you through, you know, a whole adventure. In that sense, the piece is different. But I think what characterizes the difference of the Imago Mundi and the other works around it, because that was written in 73, is the fact that a large part of this music derives from my then very new fascination with Japanese music, and specifically the ceremonial music of the court, the, what they call gagaku music. I did not use any traditional instruments, but I found a way, I think, to make the Western orchestra not sound like the Japanese instruments, but it would be a kind of how a Westerner, let's say, filters through the experience of the Japanese qualities.
Let's hear the beginning of Imago Mundi, written by my guest, George Rockberg, and performed by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra with conductor George Salty. We just heard part of Imago Mundi, written by my guest George Rockberg, performed by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra with George Schulte conducting. That's a really interesting piece. Did you travel to the East, or is it just through listening that?
No, this is the one time in my life when I did travel, when I was deeply affected by the culture. I mean, if an American goes to Europe, pretty much, even if you've never been there, but you're going to recognize a lot of things. But if you go to Japan, as I did in 1973, it was a marvelous experience in every way. And it just opened me up to all kinds of things which I had felt. I mean, I had had some experiences, we all do, with haiku, and I'd seen some of the work of Japanese artists like Hiroshige and Hokusai, and enjoy them very much, and found them very fresh in their way of hitting the eye and their way of depicting things. Specifically, I fell madly in love with no drama and the various kinds of music that surround the ceremonial performances in the old court. What I did find, to my surprise and somewhat disappointment, was that most Japanese are less interested in these old traditional things than, let's say, I was. It was very difficult finding the actual theater where they were going to do this, you know, performance of No. But we did finally manage to get there. And so after coming back, when we returned, and I had to write this piece for the Baltimore Symphony, I felt, well, this is one time when I'm going to let the effect of another culture really move through me. So this was the end result.
You've retired from the University of Pennsylvania after 23 years of serving on the faculty, several years of serving as chairman of the music department, composer in residence. Is it changing your life a lot to not have that the constant workload that you have when you're on the faculty of a university?
Well, the only major change, Terry, is that now I can concentrate absolutely on my own work.
Is it easier to concentrate with that amount of time, or is it distracting to have?
Oh, I've longed for it all my life. So it's not so much a question of whether it's harder or easier. It took some adjustment, but it was not a terribly long period of adjusting. I'm happy to be in a period now where the things that I want to do are possible, whereas in the old days it was a question of figuring out or finding, you know, those segments of time where I could accomplish the things that I had to carry out. In a way, too, I like the more leisurely pace. I mean, when I work hard. But between now, I have greater opportunity to read, to do some traveling, to see friends, and just let any new ideas come up.
Do you expect to remain here in the Delaware Valley?
I think so. Of course, I do long for 70 degrees all year long, but I can't imagine pulling up stakes just for that. Because there's too much of, old associations and friends and everything that goes with that.
That's good to hear you'll be around.
Oh, I will. Absolutely.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us and for discussing your life and thoughts and your music with us. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Composer George Rockberg has been my guest, and he does live in suburban Philadelphia. He was affiliated with the University of Pennsylvania for about 23 years as chair of the music department, composer in residence, professor of humanities. He just retired from the University of Pennsylvania. His work has been performed by many symphonies. He's won several awards and is really known around the world for his music.